So here I am, Sam Evans Brown, reporting from Closet Studio, I think it's like 4.0.
Nice.
And with me virtually on Zoom, like the entire world, for some reason, despite privacy concerns, is producer Taylor Quimby. Where does today's story begin?
Well, it begins, as many stories like this do, a long, long time ago, with an old amateur scientist.
While engaged in the forenoon of Thursday, September the 1st, in taking my customary observation of the forms and positions of the solar spots, an appearance was witnessed, which I believe to be exceedingly rare.
So these are the words of 19th century amateur astronomer and Charles Darwin Beard impersonator Richard Carrington. Now, Carrington was, as everybody knows, the author of Catalog of 3,735 Circumpolar Stars.
A classic.
But we are here to talk about an event that happened in late summer of 1859 when he witnessed history whilst observing the sun.
I had secured diagrams of all the groups and detached spots and was engaged at the time in counting from a chronometer when, with the area of the Great North Group, two patches of intensely bright and white light broke out.
Now, it may seem that a bright spot on the sun is of little consequence. So to translate why this is such a big deal is Noah Lugaz, research associate professor at the Space Science Center at the University of New Hampshire.
Typically, I mean, there are flares, what you call them, so large emission of light from the sun every day, but they are mostly visible in the ultraviolet and X-ray emission. So unless you have an X-ray filter, which at the time people didn't have, you wouldn't see that. But this one was so bright that you actually see it in the emission of the sun, just like imagine a light bulb exploding. So it's something you can see with the naked eye without any equipment.
And what's more, Carrington wasn't the only one to see this. Another observer, independent of him, saw the same bright flash and jotted down his findings.
And I guess that was it for that day. But then the next night,
the northern lights go crazy.
Some people actually, you know, think it's even daylight kind of starting. And it's report from newspapers that people could read the newspaper at 1 a.m. in the middle of the night. So just imagine how bright this aura is. Where, I mean, it's pretty much as bright as sunlight.
People must have legitimately thought the world was ending. How have I not heard about this before? Like, northern lights as bright as the sun.
Yeah. But there's another big weird thing here. These northern lights were not entirely northern. So yes, there were recorded sightings in the more typical latitudes where auroras are common, like Toronto, Canada.
The whole night sky was covered with a brilliant mass of streamers, patches, and luminous bands.
And Lewiston, Maine.
Long brushes of pale white light were shooting up from the west and also the east.
But the sightings are also coming from places like Indiana.
The most extraordinary display of the Aurora Borealis I have ever witnessed.
There are reports from newspapers in Mississippi.
Mississippi?
A belt of white light tinged with pink shot up from the northern horizon to the height of 20 or 25 degrees.
And even the director of an observatory in Havana, Cuba.
At the second hour, the aurora had attained its highest magnificence. The heavens then appeared stained with blood and in a state of complete conflagration.
So that's what I mean when I say, go crazy.
I love this. I have to say, one of my favorite ways to think about the aurora is as this light show that we get when the planetary defenses are like all geared up, keeping us safe from the craziness of the sun. So I have to say, like, sign me up for this. Like, in my lifetime, I would like to see the light show of this proportion.
Hold that thought until you've heard the whole story.
So at the time, the most advanced technology was telegraph. Which, you know, we don't use anymore, but the basic idea is, you know, you run some current inside a telegraph line to send a message.
The same night, telegraph machines around the world start spitting sparks, or in some cases, working without being plugged into a battery, without being attached to a power source.
Oh, terrifying.
Yeah. This is like the sort of thing you see in a horror movie, right? Where you, like,
yep.
You know, there's like a TV on, and then it's the static, and then somebody pulls the plug, and it's still going.
That's pretty much what happened. So people turn off their telegraph, and they could still send message and receive messages, and I'm pretty sure that freaks them out. I think probably some telegraph line burst just because of how strong the current was running through them.
This incident, the lights, the telegraph wires, the whole thing, is now referred to as the Carrington Event, after our friend who witnessed the bright light on the sun just before it started.
My first impression was that by some chance, a ray of light had penetrated a hole in the sun.
Now, if that whole thing sounds scary to you, or maybe even a little cool, Sam, I want you to imagine that this didn't happen in 1859. Imagine that it happened today. And instead of telegraph machines going haywire, imagine that it was our electric grid. Imagine no radio, no GPS,
quarter of a mile,
no electricity, no music.
That sounds bad. That's a catastrophe.
It is indeed.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Today, Taylor tells us the story of an event that changed how humans view the sun. An event that, if it happened today, would wind up being very, very not cool. This is a story that asks, how do you prepare for a disaster that always seems incredibly far away until it's not?
Okay, Sam, have you ever heard of the phrase a black swan event?
Yes, because we are in one, supposedly.
Right, right. So for listeners who have not heard of this, a black swan event is a seemingly improbable and highly disruptive thing that the world isn't ready for, but in hindsight, that we should have seen coming. So back in 1859,
flashes and pulsations continued with varying brilliancy until after 11 o'clock.
People didn't have the scientific knowledge to really understand what was happening during the Carrington event, but that's not the case anymore. Now, you know, we have the tech, we have the scientific knowledge to know what and how often these sorts of things happen.
Right, because we know solar science now.
Right, right. Speaking of which, do you know what you must know what a sunspot is.
Yeah, it is an area of low solar activity, a dark patch on the sun.
Right, a spot on the sun. And they form because there are these areas where the sun's magnetic field, it gets all twisted up, it like cools down the surface, and it stores up what you might call, or what I am going to call, solar fuel.
And then sometimes you just get so much of this energy being in the sunspot that just break up and explode.
In terms of explosion, I mean, is this like an explosion you would see like from TNT? I mean, is it like literally blowing up on the surface? Like,
yeah, it's literally blowing on the surface, except it's, you know, billions of nuclear bombs where you kind of level of things.
When these explosions are big enough to send stuff shooting into space like this, they're called CMEs, or coronal mass ejections. And they send waves of radiation and little particles traveling at ridiculously high speeds. If they hit the Earth, that is a geomagnetic solar storm, which is what we call the thing that was the Carrington event.
This is what I was saying, that like the northern lights are the Earth's defenses. But doesn't that also tell us that this is happening all the time? Because the northern lights are happening all the time.
They do, yeah. The sun goes through this cycle where activity goes up and down.
Typically, you're going to have maybe one or two eruptions a week during solar minimum, and maybe you're going to have three or four per day during solar maximum.
But most of them are, you know, they're either so weak that we're protected by the Earth's magnetic field, or they just miss the planet. It's like a gun being pointed away from the Earth.
Right. Like space is big and in 360 degrees and the Earth is small and in just one spot.
Exactly. But when they do hit, the effects can be very weird because what these things do is, they screw up all our modern technology.
Like Zoom? No, not Zoom.
Zoom would be down everywhere. Can you imagine?
It's like we'd all be on Skype again.
No, Skype would be down too.
Oh, God. I can't believe my brain. Oh, my brain is so broken. Can you imagine, though, like the Carrington event and the coronavirus? Oh.
It's not worth imagining. It's
yeah.
Not. In 1967, a solar storm interrupted surveillance radars and momentarily pushed U.S. forces to scramble for the possibility of nuclear war. Mm. In 1972, a solar storm detonated remote magnetically operated sea mines in South Vietnam. Like, they just exploded on their own.
God.
And this storm also happened to strike in between the last two Apollo missions. And had astronauts been out in open space, they could have been hit with a lethal dose of radiation.
God.
So, Sam, do you want to hear the worst case scenario? What scientists think if a solar storm as big as that original Carrington event hit the U.S. today, what that would do?
Do I want to hear about this right now as I'm in my closet in the midst of a pandemic?
Yes, you do.
Like, in the same way that I must look at the car accident as I creep by on the highway, yes, hit me with it.
Okay. 20 to 40 million Americans without power.
Okay.
For somewhere between, and this is a big range here, 16 days to 1 or 2 years.
2 years, Taylor?
I'm not finished. Total economic cost, somewhere between $0.6 and $2.6 trillion.
Oh, my God. Can I just ask why? Like, what is it that breaks in the grid that would put it down for 2 years?
Well, it's the biggest transformers that are the problem. For listeners, I know you know this, Sam, but those are like the big, weird, metal-y boxes that you see in certain spots behind chain-link fences. And they're the things that transition between high voltage and lower voltage. And in an event like this, the risk is that some of the big transformers might literally overheat and melt. And it's like really specialized manufacturing to make these things. They're handmade by specialized electricians that spend like a decade as apprentices. And if you were to order one today, it would take a year and a half or 2 years to get it.
Whoa.
So, you know, think about what would happen if a ton of these were destroyed all at once.
It would be the true black swan.
Where most of us are caught with our pants down. But afterwards, the experts will point to reports and science and be like, guys, we knew this was coming. Eventually.
Yeah. I think we need to take a break.
Yeah. This closet's so uncomfortable.
Welcome back to Outside In. I have caught my breath. I am Sam Evans Brown.
And I am producer Taylor Quimby.
Bad News Bears, Taylor Quimby.
Yeah, that's me. And this is what it sounds like when a very expensive satellite doesn't quite make it to orbit.
I think we've lost telemetry. We have a slight telemetry loss.
I wish to express my deepest apologies.
The total cost of that satellite was over $400 million, so it was rather an expensive loss that day. My name is David Wade. I'm a space underwriter for the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium, which is a consortium of Lloyd's syndicates that underwrite satellites.
They really do have insurance for everything, don't they?
They do indeed. So I called David because coronal mass ejections, or CMEs, could pose a real serious threat to satellites. And I figured David, who has built satellites and taught people to build satellites and now insures satellites, has a real incentive to, you know, try and sound the alarm about this possible future Carrington event, Carrington level event. I don't know what you call it. Carrington event 2.0.
So this is where we hear about how all the experts have been warning us for years. And so now that's why this is a black swan and why we should have seen it coming.
Right.
Yeah, I've always had an interest and a concern about CMEs. I mean, across the space insurance market, there's about $30 billion of exposure in orbit.
So this, Sam, is the scene in the movies where the expert comes like running in with their arms full of binders and charts and papers and is like trying to get politicians to pay attention, but he gets like laughed out of the room and they're like, nerd,
the ink stain on your jacket.
Yeah, that's pretty much this scene, I think, in real life.
So in terms of space weather, we have two realistic disaster scenarios considering space weather.
One, so David says that contrary to what might be your instincts on this, CMEs do have an impact on satellites, but it's not as bad as you would think. Really what they do is they damage the solar panels a little bit. They make them less efficient. So if we did have a Carrington event,
we think worst case, that would probably be something like 5% loss on every satellite that's in orbit.
So, like, only a few billion dollars worth of insurance claims, he tells me.
Just a few billion, no big deal. There's, like, individual humans in the United States who could cover that.
Oh, sad.
Yeah.
All in all, David is worried about CMEs, and he says there will be impacts because of the damage to satellites. But it's like, that's just not the thing.
We are ever more reliant on the services that satellite provide. And a major event, even if it did not affect the satellite itself, would certainly lead to things like communication signals being knocked out, GPS signals being knocked out. And the more and more life becomes reliant on those kinds of services means it's going to be a bigger impact.
David helped to co-author one of the dire reports that I looked over for this story. And while David is ostensibly a space guy, the report wound up being mostly about things happening down on Earth, like all the ripple effects caused by this extended loss of electricity.
Food wastage, transportation systems would be affected, pumping of water supplies, pumping of sewerage.
And as we're seeing today with the coronavirus, like everything is connected, right? You cancel schools, well then, where do some kids who rely on meal programs eat lunch? And how do healthcare workers get to the hospital if they don't have daycare? It's just one ripple after another.
Yeah, and what are the consequences of those long blackouts? You know, do we then start to see shops running out of food? Do we start to see civil unrest? The consequences are enormous.
Do you struggle in your work generally to convince people that this is stuff that matters?
I would say where we've struggled is we've written these reports for Lloyd's and they don't seem to get too much uptake from other underwriting divisions.
This is the ridiculous Hollywood moment where you see that we're not listening to the experts. Basically, David says he and the other space insurance nerds read up this disaster scenario report. They wanted to warn all the other insurers, like the ones that cover factories and electrical grids, and be like, guys, you need to be prepared for this. This is crazy.
But as soon as that report was released, it got sent straight to the space underwriters, who were the ones that wrote the report in the first place.
So they just like literally glanced at the title and they were like, oh, space weather.
They sent it back to the people that wrote it. Like, oh, you guys should read this.
Thanks, everybody.
It is very difficult to get other people interested in a risk that they've never paid a claim on. And until people start paying some claims on some of these risks, I don't think it will ever be taken seriously.
So is anybody out there doing anything to like prevent or to mitigate this like possible disaster?
Yeah, for sure. There's like a bunch of people and the government, especially, you know, for military reasons, you know, they really do care about this sort of thing. There's this space weather action plan that the Trump administration has put out and I looked through it and it's like kind of a to-do list of things that are like figure out what to do. The plan is like come up with a plan.
Right.
There are some new standards for transformers and we might start getting transformers that are better prepared for this sort of thing this decade, sometime in the 2020s. And you know, there's also a lot of people working and trying to figure out the forecasting angle. Like how can we have more advanced notice of when a CME is gonna hit the planet?
Like, so how much of a heads up do we have right now?
Well, it's not good.
I can give you a forecast with maybe half an hour warning, which is going to be almost perfect. Scientifically, we're going to be good enough maybe, you know, with new missions and in a decade to give you, you know, 30 minutes or a few hours warning almost perfectly that you can actually make a decision on this. But to get a 1 day or 2 day advance warning, that's probably not in my lifetime. So then it's what's going to happen is people are going to ride the storm, if I may say.
Is it a major disaster waiting to happen? It's a difficult question to answer. If it's not taken seriously, then yes.
Can I just say that as much as this seems to meet the criteria of a black swan, like it is a blind spot that we should be paying attention to, but we aren't, it just feels like there's so many things in this category. Like like the massive earthquake that we're due for in the Pacific Northwest, like mega droughts in the Midwest, like pandemics, right? I mean, like we're told all the time that we're right on the cusp of disaster. And I guess part of me is just like, I don't want to believe this, but is this just fundamental to the human condition that we can't grapple with risks that just seem remote and unlikely?
It really does feel like that. And this is why, especially given current circumstances, I wanted some good news, like a little bit. I wanted to know, what would it look like to be better?
So it's all very well to say, oh, well, I've only seen white swans, so therefore black swans or pink swans or blue swans don't exist. But where's our creativity? Where's our imagination? Where's our innovation?
So this is Ilan Kelman. He works at two very relevant organizations right now.
The Institute for Risk and Disaster Reduction and the Institute for Global Health.
And Ilan is basically like, even if we do get hit by an event that is truly unpredictable, I don't know, aliens, we should and can build our communities better so that whatever happens, we can handle it. Or maybe not handle it, but like handle it better than we would otherwise.
Ensure that we have heroes like Will Smith ready to pilot the alien spacecraft.
Right. We should be more like actors.
Let's do away with black swans. Let's not be surprised, but let's be ready for anything that we create for ourselves or that nature throws at us.
Right. So he's saying that we should just be more prepared, generally speaking.
Yeah. I've heard it called the all hazards approach.
And what does that look like? Like, what does that mean?
Basically, 2 weeks of food and water, flashlights, wind-up radios, batteries, medication, hygiene stuff. It's actually the same sort of stuff that we should have had before this pandemic, and then everybody is hearing about now, before they started searching for toilet paper.
Taylor, is this what's supposed to be the good news? Like... like, just have 2 weeks worth of food and water. I just feel like we're advising listeners to become preppers.
No. Preppers are like ready to be in a bunker by themselves for the rest of their lives. And there is a real, real difference in what Ilan is talking about.
I prefer not to call it prepping or surviving. I prefer to call it living. There are so many different groups out there and so many phrases, whether it's prepper or survivalist. A lot of them are only individualistic. They're interested in surviving for themselves, by themselves, without linking into wider society. What we're advocating is that people take responsibility as much as they can for their own lives, and where they can't, that we create the structures to help others. So disaster preparedness is about community.
If you think about it, 2 weeks is not a huge amount of time to be ready for. This is not like advocating for people to be ready to cut themselves off from society. So the rest of the picture is to build up communities, create connections between folks who have the power and the privilege to be independent, and the vulnerable populations who don't have that luxury. Things that just make communities better places to live, like all the time.
And so rather than having emergency preparedness be this siloed effort that's individually funded and separately organized, how do we bring that into closer contact with the routine social service and economic operations of a community?
This is Anita Chandra, VP and Director of Social and Economic Well-being at the RAND Corporation. She's watching this whole pandemic play out, and, you know, she's seeing people adapt. She's also seeing people and organizations fail. And really, she's watching to see what happens afterwards.
The question will be, you know, what do we now take into our plans and policies going forward so these innovations aren't fleeting, they're actually baked in because we will be in this situation again. Can you make sure that you're a learning system? Are you actually taking the lessons from COVID-19 into your plans and policies in the future?
Again, I don't want to be just the guy who's grumpy in his closet here, but I am feeling some cynicism that we might not take the right lessons away from this pandemic, or at least that we'll forget them like relatively quickly.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, the example of this, the Spanish flu was really only just a century ago, which is not that long. And did anybody remember that before all this started?
Yeah. I feel like people think that everything changes. Like, oh, it's different now, you know? I don't know. But whatever, like my one last attempt to convince you that we might just stand a chance of averting this particular disaster. Some places have already had a brush with it.
It happened during the night at 2 hours and 44 minutes a.m., the 13th of March, 89. When I wake up in the morning, there was no electricity.
So this is Gilbert Sibyl, a research engineer that has worked for Hydro-Québec since 1978. Now, people who remember our Powerline series will recall Hydro-Québec is this massive public utility that supplies power to all of Quebec and exports also to the United States. Now, in 1989, a just huge solar storm hit Canada and knocked out power to all of Quebec for 9 hours.
And the media was were very skeptical about that, because it never happened before. We were the first power utility to experience a blackout due to a geomagnetic storm.
But since then,
he spent something on the order of $1.5 billion.
So that's John Kappenman, an electrical engineer who's been authoring these big government reports and trying to get the U.S. to take the threat of geomagnetic storms seriously since the early 2000s. He says they installed these things called series capacitors.
They went the expensive route, yeah. You know, they didn't really have an option back in the early 90s. I was just...
And now, according to both Gilbert and John, Quebec is ready.
So people are asking if this could happen again. Sure, it could happen again, and we have simulated that phenomenon. So we can only work with probability, but we have to be prepared to the worst case.
And get this, John says, for the U.S. to install the 300 Carrington-proof transformers that we would need to defend ourselves against a really, really big solar storm, it would only cost the entire country $1 billion, which, if you divide it out between all the people paying electricity bills throughout the United States,
it's the equivalent of an extra 50 cents per year, you know, about the cost of a postage stamp.
Okay, now for real though, sign me up. Like, I will chip in my 50 cents a year so that we can have the Fantastic Light Show and not have a catastrophic societal collapse afterward.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if there was ever a moment in which spending a little bit of money up front to avoid spending a lot down the line was going to be really appealing, like, I think that moment is now.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, everybody, now while you're thinking about the fragility of society, let's talk about, like, readiness for cyber attacks and super volcanoes and mega droughts and...
Oh, good one.
You know, the return of the dinosaurs and alien attacks.
Put that in there.
Yeah.
That was producer Taylor Quimby on the Carrington event. A massive solar flare is, of course, not the only large-scale disaster that many of us could face in our lifetimes. Climate change presents a number of grim possibilities, like sea level rise and increasingly unpredictable weather events. And obviously, we're in the midst of the ongoing coronavirus pandemic, an invisible but ever-present life-threatening danger. And all that ambient noise affects our brains.
I think there are multiple ways that the coronavirus actually affects our brain. A big one is that it constantly keeps our brains in a panic mode.
That's journalist Stephanie Fu, former producer for This American Life and Rosalyn Carter Mental Health Fellow. She's writing a book on healing from complex PTSD, which is a form of post-traumatic stress disorder caused when trauma is recurring, like in the case of child abuse or neglect.
I mean, I really think that trauma is the most contagious disease there is. I think it is a real health crisis.
Last week, Stephanie Fu wrote an article for Vox. The headline is "My PTSD Can Be a Weight, But in This Pandemic, It Feels Like a Superpower." Here's our producer, Justine Paradise, speaking with Stephanie Fu about her article and the intersections of mental health and disaster.
Yeah, so I was diagnosed with complex PTSD in 2018. And when I was first diagnosed, everything I read about complex PTSD made it seem like I had a disability of some sort. There were so many upsetting symptoms that I read about that I recognized in myself, like sudden aggression or depression or anxiety or like an unhealthy relationship to my abuser or dissociation. And I just thought, this makes me a freak. This makes me not normal. But after the pandemic started and we started sheltering in place in New York City, I found myself in this weird position where it seemed like everyone else around me was freaking out a lot more than I was. I was actually strangely calm. And it brought up, I started thinking about some conversations that I'd had with my therapist before the pandemic, where he essentially told me that PTSD is only a mental illness in times of peace and calm. Because in times of war, PTSD is actually this amazing adaptation. Like, our brains are trying to protect us. They're not trying to betray us in this evil way. They've just taught us, like, this is how you behave in war. You are hypervigilant. You know, you prepare for the worst. You are anxious. And so in that way, because everybody else is feeling that right now, I am totally sane. This is a totally rational response. And because I've had much more experience than most people in dealing with this sort of everyday constant barrage of threat, I'm actually handling this way better than a lot of my quote unquote, you know, well-balanced, well-bred friends around me.
Right. The neurotypical.
Neurotypical. Yeah. I mean, I'm empathetic, and there are definitely hard days. I don't want to say that this every person with PTSD or depression or anxiety is thriving right now, but some of us are. And I think it's kind of been really healing for me, actually, because it's made me understand that this isn't a disability. It's actually a healthy adaptation in some situations. And in times of crisis or high stress, it can make me a really valuable resource to society. I'm here for people, you know?
Yeah.
I've been able to contribute and stay calm and stay productive and help people move their way through panic attacks and moments of terror. And I think that's a really powerful thing, because I think one of the worst symptoms of anxiety, OCD, complex PTSD is this level of self-loathing and shame. And this has been tremendous in alleviating some of that shame.
What does a kind of ever-present, like, invisible threat like a coronavirus pandemic, what does it do to our brains in terms of stress?
When we're afraid, our bodies and our brains pump stress chemicals through our body, like cortisol and adrenaline. And these actually activate panic centers in our brain. They can turn off our prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that controls logic and reasoning, and it can sort of set off our amygdala, which is the part of the brain that controls the fight or flight response. So essentially, going into fight, flight, or freeze mode might mean that we are aggressive, that we might be oddly eating a lot of food, that we might be strangely lazy, like we might not be able to do work or fill out spreadsheets. And that's totally normal, because if you see a bear or something in the woods, it doesn't make sense that you would have this completely rational response. No, you would just want to run. You would want to get away. You'd want to scream. And so that's kind of this very natural adaptation that our brains are doing in trying to protect us when we are this afraid.
What are some tools or techniques, like an example of one maybe, that people could use to, if they're feeling like, oh, this lack of focus, this not being in my body, that's me. How can I recenter myself and get my brain out of survival mode?
So the part of our brain that has these sort of toxic cyclical thoughts of just like, oh no, what am I going to do? I'm a piece of crap. Oh my God. Actually can't really function at the same time as the part of your brain that is taking in your surroundings in a really slow and purposeful way. And so what are called grounding exercises. It sounds a little woo-woo, but it's actually scientifically grounded in fact, can really, really work. So these are mindfulness techniques. Like, doesn't need to be meditation if meditation is really intimidating for you. You can simply do things like pay attention to your breathing for a few minutes, listen really, really intently to a beautiful song, look outside and really pay close attention to the breeze and the bird song, or eat something. It could be anything. You could treat yourself with a piece of chocolate and just eat it really slowly and focus, like, what does this taste like in different parts of my mouth? Like, what are the textures that I'm experiencing? How are the textures changing? Just being really observant in a super, super mindful way can be really helpful. Of course, if you're going through a major panic attack, you're freaking out, you're overwhelmed, it can be really difficult to slow down that much. And so one really easy technique that I have done and that works for me in terms of taking me from like a 10 to like a 6 is just counting the red things or the blue things in a room. Again, it's that same part of the brain that is just noticing, and it counteracts the brain that is worrying around trying to create some terrifying narrative for yourself. It's been really helpful for me. Learning about just how my brain works. It's kind of like you get to hack the computer a little bit. Also, I think it's really important to like reach out and talk to people. It's okay to be vulnerable right now.
This just feels like the coronavirus pandemic feels like it might be one of many disasters that we'll face sort of collectively in our lifetimes, like specifically thinking about climate change and frequency of like intense and chaotic weather events or sort of droughts or more. I mean, climate change is sort of chronically difficult to point to and be like, this is climate change. But but the sense of this threat and this thing that we'll be all facing, this might be a tool that like becomes more and more useful for a lot more of us to be able to like regulate our brains and our anxiety.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, even without massive apocalyptic issues, I think that mental health has been a real and a growing problem in America for a very long time. There's some crazy statistic where it's like 1 in 5 people are dealing with some mental health issue. And I think there's some truth behind that saying, hurt people hurt people. I think that the more you are traumatized by horrible things in the world. It could be child abuse. It could be losing your home in a tornado. It could be, you know, losing your mother to coronavirus at a young age. It could be being separated from your parents at the border. These traumatic events have the potential to give us a sense of entitlement or hurt that makes us less sensitive to the hurt of other people around us. And I think when you have so much trauma abounding, the way to prevent that trauma from sort of having these shock waves of hurt that just keep resonating out within our community is to protect mental health, is to make these people feel loved and cared for and safe. So we don't spread this trauma and this hurt around to other people, that instead we are able to spread kindness and have that be the shockwaves that are resonating within our community, is love and generosity and gratitude for each other.
That was Justine Paradise speaking with Stephanie Fu. She's a freelance writer and journalist working on a book on what it's like to recover from complex PTSD. She's also a former producer at This American Life and Snap Judgment, and she's a 2019-2020 Rosalind Carter Mental Health Fellow. Outside In, we'll be right back after a break. You're listening to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Last week, a New York Times article pretty much blew up the internet. That's pretty normal. What was rare was this story was about conservation biology. It was a story about an invasive species.
Back now with what's called murder hornets, reported in the U.S. for the first time. Here's
ABC's... Yes, murder hornets. A 2-inch-long invasive Asian hornet with an extra venomous sting that can penetrate protective clothing and decimates honeybee hives, mashing up their lovable prey into so-called meatballs that they feed to their young. As if we didn't have enough to worry about. The freakout was palpable.
If the bees go, we go. So they pollinate 1 in 3 pieces of food we eat. So we have to protect these little guys.
Now, the hornets have been found in one small town on the border between Washington State and British Columbia. Another 2 nests were found in the fall of last year on Vancouver Island in Canada and exterminated. So while it does seem that it's possible that the species is starting to establish itself, the odds that you will have to worry about being stung by a giant invasive hornet anytime in the near future are vanishingly small. So no, you should not yet be adding getting stung by murder hornets to your list of things to worry about. But the fact that the odds of encountering one of these terrifying bugs is so small also offers up a tantalizing possibility. Might it be possible to halt the invasion of the murder hornets before it's too late? Monica Cooper might be able to give us some insight into that question. She's a farm advisor with the University of California.
And being a farm advisor means that I am helping growers in Napa County solve problems.
Napa County, of course, is home to very famous vineyards, which is why in 2009, when they realized they had an infestation of European grapevine moth, folks were freaked out.
It got everybody's attention, that's for sure, for multiple reasons. One, because there was one property that essentially lost their entire crop, millions of dollars, and two, because like you said, it's mainly grapevines here. So because it's a fairly monoculture agriculture, any pest or disease that comes in is really disconcerting because of the effects that it could have industry-wide.
So the trouble with moths, which I should also mention is the trouble with hornets, is that they fly. So how is it that you go about stopping an invasion of a species that can take to the wing and, you know, spread?
As part of the program, there were very strict quarantine restrictions on movement of materials and grapes, anything coming out of the vineyard. So there are posts that are part of the trellis system in vineyards, and that there were some posts that were probably had pupa of the moth on them. They were moved from Napa County to Fresno County, and that was one way it was able to move. So when I say anything coming out of the vineyard, all equipment had to be sanitized, all the picking bins that they used had to be cleaned, loads of grapes had to be tarped, and anything related to the trellis system couldn't move out of the county.
One thing they had on their side, the grapevine moth wasn't a new pest.
Because it was a pest that had been known in Europe for so long, the pheromone had been identified, and a pheromone is a chemical produced by an insect that usually the female to attract the male for mating.
They made traps using a synthetic version of this pheromone. So, thanks to the quarantine, they helped keep the infestation local. Thanks to the traps, they were able to test continually and know where the infestation was still a problem. And thanks to the fact that this pest threatened an industry that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, they got resources.
I mean, this wasn't a cheap program.
Which, if we take the grapevine moth, a rare story of a successful effort to contain an invasive winged insect, and apply its lessons to the Asian giant hornet, what can we say about the odds that its spread will be contained? The one thing that it strikes me that people worried about it have got going for them is that it threatens honeybees. And honeybees obviously are an insect that has got a constituency, right? You've got commercial beekeepers who are really freaked out already about the state of their charges and are really motivated to keep them safe. So, and of course, now you've got a giant media storm telling people like, hey, report this if you see it. So it's like, at least they've got two things going for them.
It really gonna come down to sort of the biology and the logistics of, you know, where these hornets are living, how easy it's going to be to find them and, you know, kill them.
Yeah. Monica Cooper, thank you so much for taking the time.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Monica Cooper is a farm advisor with the University of California. Up next on Outside In, a bug you should actually worry about. It's May. That means warmer weather one day, maybe. Perhaps some spring gardening and ticks.
Oh, it's tick season. It's tick season. It's tick, tick, tick-tock season.
Our own Taylor Quimby, host of Outside In's spin-off podcast Patient Zero, is offering up some practical advice on how to avoid or to handle tick-borne disease. Today, how to not get bitten by a tick.
With so many activities off-limits, New Englanders are increasingly looking for safe ways to shed their cabin fever and enjoy the great outdoors.
I just see a lot more people outside on trails and hiking and that kind of stuff.
But while politely stepping off a trail to let someone pass can lower your risk of catching COVID-19, it might just increase your risk of getting something else.
You know, keep your social distance, but don't pick up ticks.
This is Kirby Stafford, Connecticut's state entomologist and the primary author of the Tick Management Handbook from the Connecticut Agricultural Experimentation Station. Lyme disease is just one of the illnesses spread to humans through the bite of the black-legged tick, sometimes referred to as a deer tick. But while ticks can be picked up on a faraway trail, Kirby says most people pick them up closer to home.
Yard work was 18%, gardening was 12%, and play outdoors was 47%.
Which is why tick-borne disease prevention starts at the sock drawer.
Clothes have to be tight, the socks over the pants.
Maria Duke-Wasser is a disease ecologist at Columbia University.
I work on understanding how the environment affects people's risk of acquiring diseases.
Avoiding tick bites, she'll tell you, is all about
wearing protection.
That means light-colored clothing, no exposed skin, and for the tick pros anyway, a chemical called permethrin.
The military uses that, and we use that, and it's very efficient.
There are the skin-based repellents, some of which you may know. DEET, picaridin, and lemon eucalyptus are all approved for use by the EPA. But the advantage of a clothing-based repellent like permethrin is that you don't have to apply it every time you go out.
It will stay in the fibers of your clothes, and so even if you wash your clothes, it stays there.
It's the same material that's often used in malarial bed nets. It comes in spray cans. You get it at sporting goods stores, things like that.
But let's be realistic. Not many people are going to wear pants and socks all summer long.
I have fellow researchers that will wear Tyvek suits, and I'm sitting there, well, I'm balancing the risk of a tick bite versus heat stroke.
So how best to stay protected without suiting up in Tyvek every time you step into the backyard? Have pre-treated, tick-resistant clothes on standby for high-risk outdoor activities like yard work or gardening. And when you come inside?
Yeah, so I would immediately put them in the dryer.
Studies show that just a few minutes on high heat is enough to kill the ticks.
And I would go on in the shower.
And while you're wearing those clothes outside, you might as well do a few things to make your yard less tick-friendly. A majority of the ticks in your area are going to be on the edge of forest shrubbery or where stone walls meet your lawn. So some experts suggest creating a 3-foot barrier of wood chips or gravel between high-risk zones and the places you're likely to spend the most time.
And it's also a psychological barrier, too. This is your demarcation line.
And if that's too much, start simpler. Move your swing set or grill away from the edge of the forest.
Just clearing leaf litter from the edge of the lawn can reduce the number of ticks around the perimeter of the property.
No matter what steps you take, all you can do is lower your risk. Because no matter what you do,
it only takes one if you don't find it and it's infected.
That's why the single most important tick prevention measure is something you should do every day or multiple times a day. A full body tick check.
Look through every part of your body.
For you,
tick check.
Your kids,
tick check.
Your dogs, your cats,
tick check.
If this stuff seems too basic, just remember that slowing a disease can be as simple as washing your hands, or in this case, looking in your armpits.
And I can tell you, after over 30 years here of research, I've had very, very few tick bites, and I haven't gotten Lyme disease yet.
Next week, we'll talk about what happens if, despite your best efforts, you do find a tick embedded in your skin, how to get it out, how to get it tested, and more. So, you know, something to look forward to.
Thank you.
Outside In was produced this week by Taylor Quimby and me, Sam Evans-Brown, with help from Justine Paradise. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is director of the Aurora Dance Florealis and the Northern Disco Lights. Special thanks to our remote voice actors for this episode. Sean Hurley was the voice of Richard Carrington, and other voices by Jason Moon, Emily Quirk, Nick Capodice, and Daniela Ali. Thanks also to Samuel Golding. Also, special thanks to the Earth's Magnetic Field, aka our Solar Space Shield, for doing what you do. Keep it up, buddy. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Additional music in this episode by Ari De Niro and Blue Dot Sessions. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public.